This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, Sophie Savage, the Cancer Whisperer. An author shares her journey in finding courage, direction, and the unlikely gifts of cancer in her new book. All in this edition of Tell Me More. Of all life shocks, cancer is perhaps one of the most ubiquitous, touching friends, relatives, parents, or maybe even ourselves at some point in our lives. Physical devastation aside, maintaining one's personhood and dignity through treatment is one of the most daunting challenges. At age 48, happily married and the mother of a 4-year-old daughter, author Sophie Savage was diagnosed with late-stage terminal lung cancer. She was shaken to her core. Given brochures about how to cope with chemo, what to expect from the side effects of treatment, and how to tell her daughter she was going to die, no one had explained how to deal with the rage, hopelessness, terror, and grief. Determined to engage with cancer in a transformative way, she set out on researching and writing The Cancer Whisperer. It is Savage's personal account of living with cancer while coming to terms with her own humanity and mortality. Your book offers a redefinition of what it's like to experience cancer. At least the vocabulary you've offered us is a real change from the old idea of a war on cancer. I mean, you'll often hear a news story about a celebrity who's battling cancer, and we use that kind of imagery a lot in our talking about this illness. But talk about your journey and how it is you decided to take a different view of this.
Well, when I was first diagnosed, I mean, obviously I was terrified and full of despair. I had a very poor prognosis. I was riddled with tumors. And I knew at first, the first thing I needed to do was to deal with my fear and my mind. Because if you don't get hold of your fear will get hold of you, and it's going to run the show and make your decisions for you. So I spent the first few weeks while they were still finding tumors, working through my terror, actually. But I also have a background in personal development and mindset change, and I'd been teaching people how to bring their best to the toughest situations for 20 years. And I recognized that this was one of those moments, and I was determined to have a transformational experience with cancer, not a terrifying one, whether I lived or died. I couldn't control the outcome, but I could influence the outcome, but I could control the kind of experience I had while I was going through it. And the reason I wanted to change the battle language is that, firstly, it started with Richard Nixon, you know. He declared the war on cancer for political capital, and that metaphor stuck. And I think battling it and fighting it puts you in an adversarial relationship with your body as well as your illness. It also puts you in an angry, defiant state of mind, which in itself is stressful. And it also does a great injustice to the people who, in inverted commas, lose, the people who die, because they actually have so many victories of the heart and the spirit and of courage and of, you know, the cancer patients who pick themselves up off post-chemo, the floor after post-chemo, and make dinner for the kids and ride another wave of agony and make significant changes in their lives. These are victories, not losses. And so the language just bugged me in so many ways. And actually, cancer is not an enemy, it's an illness. It's an illness, and like all illnesses, it's pointing to things that are out of kilter in our bodies and in our minds and in the environment and in many places. So I wanted us to start treating cancer at minimum as an illness instead of an enemy, and more than that, as a teacher. Now, that sounds a bit cheesy, but because you need to be proactive. You're not going to get the gifts of cancer unless you work to find them. Or the lessons, unless you work to claim them. That's why I called it the Cancer Whisperer, because we used to break horses, and horse whisperers learned there was another way to be in dialogue with horses. I think there's another dialogue we can have with this illness that's much gentler and much more empowering. and much more healing, in fact.
You were 48 years old with a four-year-old daughter, a husband, and a career when you were diagnosed. How were you able to make this paradigm shift within yourself to find a new way of working with your illness and approaching it? I mean, that seems so revolutionary in the face of the kind of terror that you describe and being given no hope by some doctors at the outset. How did you find your way to this new model, a template, if you want to call it that, for approaching your cancer?
Because I'd been working in the field of mindset change and psychology for over 20 years, I had a toolkit that I could call on that I'd been teaching for years and been using for years. I mean, I'd been walking my talk in many other situations. And don't get me wrong, it took me weeks to find my way through this, maybe a couple of months. It was an Everest. And I had tools to work through it. So imagine if you don't have the tools. How do you work through the terror if you don't know how? So I used what I've been teaching for 20 years. I've put those tools in my book and other resources where you can find them. And I practiced what I've been preaching for a long time. And I also asked for help. I was not good at asking for help, by the way, before I got cancer, but you need to get over that very quickly. And I wrote to my friends and family. I realized how awkward they felt and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to help. So I wrote to them and said, this is how you can help. This is what will help me and this is what won't help me. And I gave them really clear instructions about what was helpful and not helpful.
What were some of those things that, because people want to help, they feel helpless and frightened for you and they do want to help. So what is the way you wanted to be helped?
There were some very practical things. There were some emotional. So people who've been in the kind of work that I've been in, I have friends. I called on them to come and do emotional process work with me in my house, you know, to help me apply what I teach to myself. So I got that kind of emotional support from some people and asked them to come and do that work with me. I also asked people to, I'm a terrible cook and I radically changed my diet. So I asked people to cook meals for me and bring me food. And one couple who I know well, they arrived one weekend with a boot full of organic meals and they filled my freezer for 2-3 months with really healthy food and set up water filters in my house. I mean, they were amazing. And also things like, remember my husband so that he can be my husband. Don't just ask me how I am, ask how he is. Because the partners get forgotten and they become invisible and I didn't want that to happen to him. So there were those, I mean, everyone will have their own requests. And I also had a not helpful list, like, please don't tell me to be positive. Because I feel gutted about this, and positive is not, I can't pull that out of my boots. I need to be real. And please don't tell me about the people you know who have died of this disease. It's like you say I've got cancer, and someone goes, oh, I know someone who died of that. Like, oh, I know someone who's got the same car as you. It's like a nervous reaction people have. You're like, please don't tell me about the people you know who've died of cancer when I've just been diagnosed. And I made people laugh, I think. And they stopped doing that kind of thing. And they were thrilled and said this is, they formed a team and they rallied around. And for 6 months, I had the most amazing support network, probably life-saving as well.
You talk about cancer as being something that you can be healed by. At the same time, you're trying to cure it. How did that work for you, and what lessons did you learn?
I don't think it's cancer that will heal you. I mean, cancer will kill you unless you respond to it very, very proactively and do the medical things that need to be done. So let's be clear about that. But I do think cancer puts some questions to you about how are you living your life? Are you living as healthily as you can live? What kind? I think there are psychological roots to this disease as well as many others. So in my case, I learned that in Chinese medicine, grief is held in the lungs, and I have lung cancer. Well, I learned a lot about how to work with fear and anger and resentment and many emotions over the years, but I had neglected grief almost completely. I didn't even know it until I got cancer. And so I found myself grieving things I'd never grieved, that I'd never even thought were worthy of grief, dealing with unresolved regrets, like I'd wanted to be a writer since I was 10, and I hadn't done it, and now I am. So for me, it was actually a lot about grief, but for other people, I met a cancer patient recently, and she had esophageal cancer. She had a tumor in her throat, and she was dying when I spoke to her. And she was full of rage. And she said to me, you know, Sophie, I didn't know I was full of rage until I got cancer. It took cancer for me to realize how angry I am. And I said, what did you do with all your rage? And her eyes welled up in tears, and she put her hand on my throat. She said, I swallowed it. I swallowed it all. It was like a kind of revelation to her. And she found that incredibly healing to release all her anger before she died. I wish she had lived, but she did something very healing before she died. And that's what I mean about you can still have great emotional healing even if ultimately cancer takes you out. I think you can free your spirit before you die. You don't need to wait till you die to free your spirit. And I wrote the book because I want to help people free their spirit now.
You mentioned Chinese medicine, which opens the door to talking about complementary treatments. During your experience, you had to kind of make a decision about how mainstream you would go, how integrative you would go, how Eastern you would go in your modalities of treatment. So what helped you make that decision, and what did you finally decide was the right mix for you?
Sure. It was very, very challenging, in fact, because certainly in this country, I don't know how much it happens in America, but I've heard it happens. My orthodox doctors, my oncologist said, don't bother with all that other stuff. It's quackery. It's rubbish. Just do what we tell you. And my alternative practitioners, my nutritionist or my acupuncturist, well, actually not my acupuncturist in this case, but some of those practitioners said, don't do chemo. It will kill you. So I'm stuck in the middle of these two paradigms, which are pitted against each other and discount one another at the patient's expense. I found that extremely unhelpful, and I wish they would get in a room together, shake hands, and learn from one another, really. Because they all have something to offer. And I have done significant orthodox treatments. I've been on chemotherapy. I've had radiation to various parts of my body. I'm in no doubt it's saved and extended my life, no question. And at the same time, I've done things like acupuncture and changed my nutrition and done things like high-dose vitamin C, which is common practice in Germany, actually in cancer centers in Germany. So you need to choose your shots. You need to be discerning. You need to be intelligent. You need to do your homework. You need to know that there are people out there who are going to take advantage if you let them. So you need your head screwed on. And you also need to use your sixth sense and your intuition. So I've very much done a mixture of both. And I've chosen some complementary treatments and I've chosen some orthodox treatments. And so far, it's really worked for me to do both. My acupuncturist said something wonderful because I was ranting to him about this problem. And he said, Sophie, he said, the way I see it is the chemo and the radiation, they're like the SAS, you would say the Navy SEALs probably. You know, they're here to take them out. You've got terrorists in your house, tumors. And the chemo and the radiation are here to take them out. And the rest of us are supporting the building, the land, and the innocent civilians. And I love that.
A different way to see it as a battle, but as everybody playing a role, the chemo taking it out and some of the integrative treatments helping you rebuild your health and your immunity and so forth.
Yeah, that's my philosophy. But I know people who've just done chemo and radiotherapy and got well. I know people who haven't touched chemo and radiotherapy and got well. So that either way seemed too risky for me. It just seemed a no-brainer to put them together, really.
You also talk a lot about how having cancer changed your outlook on life in terms of being more authentic, being who you were really meant to be, and of approaching your friendships that way and the way you see yourself. Talk about that shift, if you would.
Sure. I found that when I was metaphorically looking down the barrel of a gun, and I was in those early weeks, I was dying. I mean, the life force was leaving my body daily, and I could barely walk up the stairs without losing my breath. I had a tumor eating through my spinal column. It was, you know, I was in very big trouble. And when that happens, in my experience, I became lucidly clear about who and what truly mattered to me and what didn't. I found myself becoming very intolerant of pretense and anything that wasn't truthful and real in myself as well as in others. So I ended some friendships that weren't really for real, and I healed some relationships that were broken that I knew mattered to me. And I found out who really loved me. You know, the people, some people showed up I didn't expect. And some people I did expect to show up just disappeared. It was fascinating and quite hurtful at times, but also very, very clarifying. To know who loves you and to know who you love and say, this is where I'm going to invest my precious time, that is a gift. I mean, that is an extraordinary gift. And those relationships have just deepened and widened and become even richer. I mean, that's one example of an unlikely gift of cancer, which is in the subtitle to my book. So that's an example.
You also took this opportunity to make peace with your body, which is something pretty much all women struggle with. Why now? Why at this point?
I'd come a really long way with this, truthfully. I'd had eating disorders in my teens and early 20s. I think I did considerable damage back then, and sowed the seeds of my disease now. I'd done a lot of work on that over the years and come a long way. But I think cancer just turned the volume up enormously, and I needed to once and for all make peace with being in my own skin, actually. And there were some ways I hadn't done that yet. I'm aging, and, you know, it's easy to look in the mirror and judge what you see. And I wanted to stop doing that. I still work at not doing that. And I think the whole war metaphor exposed that for me even more, because I was really clear I need to make peace with my own skin right now. And if I don't make peace now, I never will. I mean, how big a wake-up call do I need to get? How loud does it need to get for me to get it?
Why does it sometimes take such a drastic turn of events to wake us up that to the fact that hating our thighs or whatever else we're finding fault with on any given day is such an utter waste of time?
I think partly we don't get it because rationally most of us understand that. But the human mind or the human ego, I mean, I call it mind talk, that voice inside your head that just rabbits on at you and says, eh, you're ugly, eh, you're fat, you know, all that rubbish. It's a crafty little sucker inside your head, and it's relentless. And unless you learn to manage that day by day and challenge it in a very profound way, it will just keep biting you in the bum, if I'm allowed to say that. That was very British, wasn't it? Biting you in the bum. it'll just keep at you and keep at you. So for me, it's about a disciplined practice to keep challenging your own thinking. It's like you're not going to get it overnight and then it's done. But equally, sometimes the consequences and the cost and the pain of it needs to get to a certain point. It needs to crescendo to a certain point that you're no longer willing to pay the price.
You also talk about the fact that for a long time and until your cancer diagnosis, you felt you had muted yourself or hidden your light from the world, that you were under the radar. We can pick any metaphor we wish, but that you had seen yourself as being very talented, but felt the need to pull back and maybe not show everything that you had. But this has freed you now to shine that light and let other people see it. And in some ways, you've kind of found yourself in the midst of this terrible, terrible disease.
Yeah. I think that for me was, I imagine a lot of people will relate to this. It was rooted for me in two things. Firstly, I'm a white, privileged British woman, and I was privately educated, and I was blessed to have all that as a child. And I felt, you know, by the time I was a teenager and I'd seen how the world was for many other people, I took on a kind of deep amount of guilt that was very, very unhelpful, and I did choose to be of service and to be grateful for my privileges, and I think I've done that all my life. But I kind of, in a way, I bent my life into an apology for being born into what others don't have, and I didn't really realize the extent I had done that. And at the same time, I think I'm very intelligent. Notice my hesitation to even say that to you, to just claim it.
Yeah.
I'm very intelligent. I'm a very good writer. I think I'm a gifted writer even. I'm very good at public speaking. And I was given all of that on top of my British passport and my whiteness and all those things that mean I can walk down the street without being afraid for my life. And I've also created success quite easily. I've always worked for what I earn. My parents didn't give me handouts. I've worked very hard all my life. But I've received a lot of envy and resentment and jealousy in my life. I've had friends just walk away saying, I can't be your friend because you're too clever for me, when I was 17. I won a big competition when I was 17, and my best friend said, I can't be your best friend anymore. And those kinds of things, they go in quite deep. And so even though I did use my privileges and I did make the best of them and I did make a difference in the world, I was selective and I hid my light under a bushel because I didn't want people to say, oh, you're so lucky, you're so blessed. I didn't want to take the heat. And I didn't want to be too awesome. Do you know what I mean? I mean, some of us believe we're not enough, and I had that belief, I'm not enough. But I also had the belief that I'm too much. I'm too much, and I have to rein myself in from being too much. And when I got cancer, I said, enough now. I'm not too much, and I'm not enough. I am who I am, and I'm going to have my full vulnerability and my full awesomeness, and I'm not going to apologize for that anymore. I'm done. I feel quite tearful saying it to you. It's enough now, and here I am talking to you. I would never have done this 2 years ago. I'd have hidden under the bed rather than come on the radio show.
And you wrote a book in 6 weeks that's been very well received about your experience and about your claiming the title Cancer Whisperer, because you do have much to teach us. How has that felt?
It's been an unexpected honor. It's been incredibly humbling. And it's... you can't plan this kind of thing. I wrote it in 6 weeks, thinking I didn't have long for this world. It wanted out, though. I self-published it. I popped it on Amazon, thinking it would reach a few weird people and might make, like me. It went to bestseller in days on Amazon, not in the top bestseller, but in several categories it went to bestseller. And then it got picked up by publishers, and it was auctioned in the US, and Penguin Random House have just published it. I mean, you don't plan this stuff, and partly it's a dream come true because I always wanted to be a writer. I've had an advance on my next book. It's my job now. I mean, how cool is that? I'm doing what I've always wanted to do, and I'm still teaching what I used to teach. But also, it's like I've been something greater, capital S, capital G, has picked me up like an arrow and fired me from its bow towards a target beyond my seeing or imagining even. And I'm a willing arrow. That's the best I can describe it. I'm playing my part, and I wrote the book, and I'm dealing with cancer, and I take credit for all of that, but there's something more than me at work here, and I need to stay humble about that and not let my ego run away with this and claim more credit than is mine.
How does the cancer whisperer talk to her young daughter about what she's going through? I imagine that's an extremely touchy area.
That's a tough one.
Area. Yeah.
She's nearly 7 now. She was 4 at the time. My husband lost his dad when he was 7 years old. And he wasn't told what was going on. His dad was in a wheelchair, but he was around and present, and suddenly he was gone. And John really took decades to get over it. And more painful for him than the loss of his dad was the lack of information, because he thought it was his fault or he'd done something wrong. And I think children pick up a lot. They sense a lot. And if you don't tell them what's going on, they often blame themselves or think they've done something wrong. So his experience dictated our decision. I mean, we've been honest with her as much as we can be. It was a slow process, but Mummy has cancer, and she said, "Duh for cancer, duh for doctor." It was kind of like that. Mummy might not be here for your next birthday. Mummy might die. She's more cognizant about it now. She's more able to understand it now, and she'll jump on my knee and say, "Mummy, I'm scared you're going to be deaded." And we talk about it, and we talk it through, and then she jumps off my knee and goes and plays again. So I think the honesty makes her feel safe, paradoxically. And if I die, she won't be blindsided, and that was really important to me.
What a moving story. That and many more in the book, The Cancer Whisperer, Finding Courage, Direction, and the Unlikely Gifts of Cancer. Sophie Savage, thank you so much for taking the time, and I want to wish you well.
It's been my pleasure, too. Thank you.
Sophie Savage's book is The Cancer Whisperer, Finding Courage, Direction, and the Unlikely Gifts of Cancer. This book chronicles Sophie's extraordinary relationship with cancer and the very effective methods she's used for dealing with her fear, anger, denial, and grief. Sophie is an inspirational writer, speaker, and facilitator who has worked in the field of human development, emotional intelligence, and corporate culture change for more than 20 years. She lives in the United Kingdom. You can learn more at sophiesavage.com. Thanks for joining me this morning. You can email the show. Just log on to morefmphilly.com and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.